Happy Odin's Day.
Happy Odin's Day.
I like to be old school and go with the older understanding of the names of our week. Hail Odin, I'm going to go pluck out an eye to the game of wisdom today.
Sounds good.
I'm not going to do that. I wouldn't really do that. This is Wednesday. This is episode 191, like nine away from
291.
We always say we're going to do something special for these big occasions, like 200, which is coming up. It's like we haven't really ever done it, so I don't know. Like,
no,
I want to find a way, because 200 is like that's when sitcoms have episode 200, they do like flashback episodes and they do all kinds of things. So we need to figure it out.
Right.
We've got nine episodes to figure it out.
Yeah, I sense failure coming, but. We could try.
It's okay. I'm accustomed to failure.
Yeah, there you go.
This is my natural habitat. So today we're talking about change. This is the second part of three. And I guess we can introduce ourselves so people know who's talking to them if they haven't already heard us before. I'm Mark Van Steenwyck. I direct the Center for Prophetic Imagination.
And I'm Daniel Wolpert. I direct MICA, the Minnesota Institute of Contemplation and Healing. And hello, Kathleen, and all other folks who are listening, paying attention. Yeah. And so on Monday, we talked a lot about philosophies of change, different issues in change. Is there change? Is there not change? A whole bunch of cool stuff. And so I thought that, well, for today, there's one very large area of our lives in which we are actually trained to want change all the time. And so I thought it would be good to talk about that, because it's a very important area of our lives and affects all kinds of things. And that is in the area of stuff.
Before we get into that, there's a couple comments I just want to get out of the way, because they're not going to make sense later. But CK says, you should do the 200th episode at night and imbibe. It's a pandemic. Day drinking is totally on the table, CK.
Really? What is night?
Why do I have to wait till night? Some sort of English gentleman? I don't even understand. Gus writes, you're well into the numbers where you should have a noir episode where you bring back a dead character. I don't even know if we've had anyone who's been dead in our show. Maybe we could animate the motionless body of Bubo using magics and sciences together into the state of alchemy. Yeah. We can use alchemy. Or maybe not. Those are some good ideas.
Those are great ideas.
Drinking and resurrection are two very good ideas.
Drinking and zombies.
Yeah. And while he's mentioning a favorite author of all time, I'm assuming you're talking about Octavia Butler, the quote. But yeah, so we're looking at change at a different angle today, which is the way in which we experience change all the time, but it's been sort of normalized in what it does to us.
CK was trying to be respectable.
Yeah, that's, I don't know you well, but I know you enough.
Like, nice try.
Nice try.
So here's a weird thing, right? So a lot of what we talked about on Monday was how hard change was, and how we don't like change and we resist change and we try to keep things the same. And in terms of the logic and the necessity of capitalism, there's one place where we have to want change all the time, right? And that's in terms of stuff. Yeah. We always want the latest, newest thing, right? Like, what's new? You know, what's coming out next season? When's the new iPhone coming out? You know, what's the new gizmo, the new device? You know, when we feel bad, when we get a little depressed, it's like, well, let's buy a new thing.
Yeah.
And this is one way in which, in fact, if you're not into that kind of change, there's all kinds of insults related to that, right? You're a Luddite, you know, you're back in the Stone Age. You know, you don't want your stuff to change, and that's terrible.
I mean, there's so many interesting facets to this idea of change, the dynamism of capitalism that are kind of concealed because we act as though it's normal. So normalized change doesn't feel like change. We were talking about this before. It's kind of like how the state says we don't, like right now, we need curfews so that there's not violence, as though we haven't been experiencing violence. Well, that's normalized state violence that we've been experiencing. And so they don't want this new kind of violence. So it's, but concepts like commoditization or commodification are kind of helpful to think about. So that's the idea in which things that use weren't really something you bought and sold now become bought and sold. And so things that used to, even like the simple thing of glass bottles, like think about when you get milk, which I've never experienced this, but I've heard tell. You get milk and you drink it from a glass bottle, leave it, and then the milkman would collect it. And so there's a sense of stability with that. Maybe not good or bad, but it's a sense of place. And then they're like, well, plastic's cheaper. So then there's this disposability starts becoming more and more of the norm. And of course, corporations then pass the buck to us for our choices rather than claiming responsibility for changing their practices. That's a whole other thing. And so this creates this idea that you have to ever consume more things, and we're being bombarded with stuff that's intrinsically disposable now.
Right. Or not even, you know, not even, and part of what comes with that disposability is like not even as good.
No.
And
we're told, you know, we're somehow told it's better.
We're told it's better, but it's not as good. And, you know, and there are two examples of this in my life that I think about all the time. So one was this truck that I had. So I had this Toyota truck, and I was trying to think what year it was. It had to have been like an 89 or a 90 maybe. Yeah, maybe a little later, mid-90s maybe. Maybe even earlier. I don't know. Somewhere around there. Anyway, this was a truck, yes, in ancient times. This was a truck that basically I felt was kind of like the perfect truck. So it was both small and lightweight, but also very strong. Ooh, Deborah's listening. 1988, she claims. I think it was earlier than that, actually. But anyway, it was both strong, but it was lightweight. So for a truck, it got actually really decent gas mileage, had an 8-foot bed, it's 4-wheel drive. It was like this perfect truck, and it wasn't all that expensive. Now, do you think they still make that truck? Of course not, right? Very quickly, they had to make new trucks, bigger trucks, quote, better trucks. They're actually worse trucks, right? But the problem is that our economic system, both in terms of employing people, right, employing engineers, employing factory workers, employing all, they, you know, they've got to scrap that model and make other new models that are bigger and better. But they're not bigger or better. They are bigger. They're not better.
I mean, it's the way, like, it's so baked in. Like, our system requires perpetual growth. That's how capitalism functions. Right. It's what drives it. And so it's weird whenever people celebrate bigger numbers in the economy, like, especially people who are ostensibly anti-capitalist, are like, Biden has brought new life to the economy. I'm like, I understand you want to get an aha over Trump by saying that kind of thing, but it's really like, we can't keep doing this. we're experiencing change, catastrophic change all the time. This, we're slowly eroding, and so that's a real change. And so somehow, when somebody says, "Oh, like we need a revolution," you're like, "Oh, we can't. That'd be violent and bring about unnecessary change, or be disruptive change." I'm like, we're already experiencing disruptive change. And it's driven, like, and then the worst thing about this, like, so not only these products are disposable, part of the critique of capitalism is that human beings have become commodities. This is where Hannah Arendt calls it superfluity. We're superfluous people. You can be, you can talk about the gig economy. Some people use the term the precariat, the proletariat that's precarious. All these terms to say, like, really, you're disposable and you actually have a price point. And so even you are an interchangeable cog. Like, you don't, we can say there's some benefits to the fact that I know that my grandson is not going to be born probably in Minneapolis and live and die here. Like, that sense of stability, some mobility is kind of nice, not be locked into a crappy life if somebody doesn't want it. But at the same time, there's a lot lost when the fact is that we don't assume people have a sense of place or a people anymore. We're all moving about, and it's becoming increasingly normalized. Like, within my lifetime, I've seen the shift away from, like, towards the celebration of not having a real future. So every day I get these, you know, articles on my Android phone. Somehow I get stuff from Business Insider, and it's always talking about how people turn their side hustle into a major million-dollar career or something. And so we see this glorification of the side hustle. The side hustle would never, when I was young, would never have been seen as a positive thing. It'd be like, oh, you're not able to make ends meet with a job? That's sad. And I was like, I got a great side hustle. It's normalized.
Right, right. Between my 80th and 90th hour of working during the week, I've got this great side hustle. All right, we've got a few comments coming in.
Aaron writes, just joining in. Good morning. Are you all going to talk about Elul's The Technological Society? I'm not planning on talking about it directly. I haven't read the whole thing, and it's been a long time. But there is a sense in which the idea is, for those, and it's worth reading, the idea is that our society of technique or processes for doing these sort of modern things becomes so dominant that it erodes other more authentic ways of being human. I mean, so there's a way that people could say Elul is a little bit of a Luddite, but he's not talking about technology and just like the newest radio, but the sort of mechanization of society and humanity into being almost technological itself. You know, and Hannah Arendt, a lot of people talk about these sorts of dynamics, and they've been talking about it for a while. Like, Karl Marx is not a new guy. But we've seen all these things they talked about accelerating more and more, and it's actually disturbing, but we're like the lobsters in the pot. We don't notice it. CK writes, so why is it so hard to do the right thing? We all know that change needs to happen, like in police reform. This is going to be the governor's legacy, riots, protest, and cop. I mean, it's partly, like, you could say that there is a lack of will individually, but more than that, it's systems are very sturdy. So it's hard to change.
The reason that we wanted to start on this angle today is in a way to show that it's not about, you know, human beings hate all change and we can't change. And why is it so hard to change? Right. Because here's an example where we love change and we change all the time. Right. And, you know, I think about within my lifetime. I mean, I remember when I was in eighth grade and they brought in a computer, which was this weird little blue box with these little white buttons in front, you know, like eight white buttons that were ordered in. It was all base 2. Right, it was zeros.
Sounds
and
like
ones.
Some sort of Victorian steampunk novel. What are you talking about?
Exactly. Yeah, and it had these little lights on the top, and you would press the buttons, and you could program this computer.
You have cards
to add 2 + 2. No, you didn't have cards. It wasn't even cards. It was like even simpler than that, right? You would like press the buttons in these little codes that would program the computer, and it. it would add 2 + 2. Like, that's what it could do at the end of the day, right? And this was this like amazing thing, right? This machine. Wow. And, you know, and now here we are, you know, broadcasting live on the internet, right? And so it's not that we are incapable of change. It's the question of what changes are we programmed as people to accept as valuable and interesting versus what changes are we told are bad and scary, right? Mm-hmm. And so part of the problem is that in this, you know, capitalist, technologically non-human alienated society, we're told that the kind of change that's good is, you know, extracting resources from the earth, that's destroying the earth, and buying more stuff and having the stock market go up. Like, that's a change that we're all excited about, you know. And change of, let's figure out how to treat other people as human beings, like that change, oh my God, that's impossible. Like, that is so radical. Well, that's not true. It's just what we're conscripted into.
Well, you know, it takes a lot of imagination and skills and capacities in order to go against the flow. So I'll use one simple example using the computer one. So when I was in school, that's when I was the Oregon Trail generation, right? So we had Oregon Trail in school. I'm like, whoa, we can play this amazing game. Look, that almost looks like a bear. Like, and so in high school is when the internet started rolling out. And so I'm kind of before the technological, the digital revolution, really. Now, because of that, I have an understanding of how it works. Like, I'm not a specialist by any means. I don't study this, but I know how to fix things better than most people younger than me. Like, I've seen this with my son, because that they're acclimated to the to it as an environment, whereas I still think about it as something external to me that I have to understand as a tool. So there's a simple little capacity shift there. Right. So if he wanted to revolt against it, he would know, because he's at, like, that's part of his environment, where it's not really fundamentally part of mine the same way. Like, I can opt out without it being as catastrophic to my sense of self and place. So there's that. But then, like, let's say you do recognize there's something needs to change, and you can understand how to do it. You're going to find everyone else around you is not really into it. So there's so, and it's because we're conditioned, the structures of our society, man, it's change that way is hard. And so it's not just about, like, I'm going to do the right thing. It's like, how do I get a collective of people to have a shared imagination and a set of practices around a thing, and then have a shared trajectory? And that's why organizing is hard as hell. Going to these comments, Kathleen writes, Harley doesn't make the best motorcycles, but cashes in on the name.
Yeah.
I don't know about motorcycles, but something tells me that's true, or at least that's how most things work. Gus writes, when I worked at a gutter company. Wow, that's a great statement right there. They had a little Mazda pickup that turned over its millionth mile. Holy shit. Well, it was there. A product that lasts that long doesn't create return customers because it lasts forever. I've heard all sorts of stories like that.
Absolutely.
But people will buy reliability.
Sometimes.
If they've got that ethic and they're intentional about it.
Right. Yeah.
Con writes, I've always wondered if we stop making stuff, would our economy collapse, since there's nothing to buy and sell? Then how do we live instead? It's hard to imagine something else besides growing our own food.
Right. Yeah. And so that's a great comment, because that's exactly true. I mean, right now, if we stopped making stuff, our economy would collapse. Because that's what it's based on, right? And as you point out, when you do this self-reflection, you're like, well, how can human beings live, right? You know, it's unimaginable, right, at this point. And of course, we forget that, you know, human beings live for about 1.5 million years without a capitalist economy, and somehow, you know, made it through the vast wasteland of a non-economic existence, you know. And as a friend of mine who's a great native teacher says, you know, yeah, it was great. You know, we hunted and fished and had sex, and like, life was really fun. And that's what we did. You know, now we're kind of all just like, oh my God, what would happen if I didn't have to like go to work and make some shitty thing? And, you know, we would all die and starve. And so this is again where certain changes that we're conditioned to make sense to us, and other changes seem literally impossible. But we have to, you know, break out of that. You know, that's a construct, right? That's something we're stuck in. You know, if one set of changes are possible, well, any kinds of sets of changes are possible.
Well, and if you get a society that says, look, we don't want to have an economy based on growth and disposability, but on sustainability and making sure needs are met, that's called a planned economy. And so, and then all of a sudden the United States and its allies decide to like subvert and undermine its attempts to have a planned economy, because that seems like authoritarian socialism, no matter how you spin it. Right. So there, things like that happen. But the reality is it's possible to not make more than we need and to find a way to do everything sustainably. And the reason we don't is because that really does, no matter how much people want to say it, undercut the profit. There's no way it doesn't diminish profits.
Right.
And so, and yeah, so that's why we don't have it. Like, it's because capitalism serves the very rich. There's a reason why 8 people have as much collective wealth as the bottom half of the entirety of the human population.
Yep.
And that's because of this system. So we got to figure out an alternative. Or at least those 8 people live on a colony on Mars, and the rest of us will be living in a zombie wasteland. Aaron says it's kind of boring. I understand. Jacques Ellul, we could blame him a little bit for being dense, and his translators, because he wrote in French, for also not being
translated. It could lull you to sleep.
Ellul. That's when you fall asleep online in Ellul. Yes. Anyways, bad pun. Gus writes, CK, sure, but we also have a system that rewards quick turnaround, not generational purchases.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. David writes, I remember the shock of a Palestinian family that I was celebrating Ramadan with in the West Bank during my sophomore year in college. Our group of 5 all went to a college away from our home state, and now we're traveling internationally without our family. The mobility was experienced as shocking and gross. The moment stayed with me. But at the time, I just thought that my mobility as a good freedom with no downside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Karen writes, there's a great short story written in 1909 by E.M. Forster called The Machine Stops. It's prescient. He talks, describes everyone living in pods, never going outside, and doing everything through view screens. Everything is controlled by the machine. It's wild how much of this dystopian story is actually happening right now. I've never heard of that short story.
Yes, Karen, that is great. You are the first person that I've actually ever met that has also read that story. I love you. That is an incredible story. And one of the key parts of that story is that the people who are inside in these pods are told that the outside is awful and dangerous and bad and evil. And so, of course, what's happening in the story is that slowly the machine, which controls everything, gives you your food, your, you know, air, oxygen, entertainment, everything, the machine starts stopping. And so this guy finally realizes that, well, either I'm going to die in my pod because the machine is going to stop, or I have to risk going outside to this horrible, dangerous place. Should I say what happens? Maybe I shouldn't. I don't know.
The odds of lots of people reading it. If you don't want to hear the spoilers, you can mute or
plug your ears, or just go like, blah, 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 blah. So what happens is he gets outside, and of course it's fine and it's beautiful. Right. And so, you know, that is this also brilliant insight about this issue of change, right? Because we tell ourselves, and, you know, you can be aware of this in yourself. You hear it all the time from other people, like, oh my God, if this changes, this is going to be so horrible, right? It's going to be so problematic. Maybe these terrible things will happen. Maybe things will be worse. You know, we talked on Monday quite a bit about this issue of abolishing the police, right? And what we're told in our mind is that things are going to be really, really awful. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that, you know, this is simply our fear mechanism where the changes that we are told are bad and we shouldn't accept, where that kicks in, right? Whereas again, these changes that are happening over and over and over again, which in many ways are equally bad, if not lots worse, especially for certain groups of people in society, those changes were like, oh no, that's fine. Like, that's okay. You know, these people are oppressed and killed, you know, like, look what's happening in Honduras right now. I mean, I don't know how many people are aware of this. It's unbelievable. This entire country is being decimated and destroyed. And again, the history of Central America is one of incredible capitalist exploitation. So we can have cheap coffee and cheap bananas and cheap labor, cheap drugs. I mean, all these kinds of things. And yet, you know, to most people in the world, it's like, oh yeah, you know, every once in a while under capitalism, an entire country gets destroyed and, oh, well, I just hope those people don't come here as illegal aliens. Mm-hmm.
And so this is where the issue, like this, the idea that humans fear change, is not entirely accurate. To me, it's like this is how myths are kind of work. One, myths are change that isn't according to the story that we're told can be scary. And then when change happens that isn't according to the story, propaganda is myth building so that to conceal the fact that the story isn't actually working. So we're kind of ensnared by these stories that are being spun. Mm-hmm. So anything that fits within the story or is concealed by the stories, it's fine. And so that's why we get afraid of like, hey, you know what? We could probably do this better. No, we couldn't. You could ruin everything. Right. So I'm like, yeah. And then you're told that you're naive, you're negative, you're foolish. That kind of change is bad.
Right. It's impossible.
A couple, some links here to some books. Gun, Germs, and Steel is a good book on change by Jared Diamond. I know there's been various critiques of that, but I know it's considered an important book for kind of like grappling with some of the ways in which material realities affect which societies advance and whatnot. Love the Machine Stops. Here's another person. You can start a book club.
Yeah, see, all the best people.
I want to be the best people. Gus writes, I totally mute you because I'm totally checking the story out. Thanks for the recommendation.
And then good.
Gregory Bentley, here's an Alan Kreider book reference. The Patient Ferment of the Early Church. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember, like, the basic premise of it is this sort of set of stability and practices that kind of won the day, right? And so that's part right. of.
Yep. Yeah, and this notion that we can start to have, you know, we can start to have a different way of being in the world, and we develop these communities that begin to, you know, ferment this new way of being, right? This new way of being in the world, and you know, and part of what spiritual practice, of course, does is it disconnects us from all of these ways that we are imprisoned in terms of how we understand change, mm-hmm. right? And it begins to allow us to be open to the reality that there's all kinds of change that's possible, right? Mm-hmm. And to realize that we have this, you know, and Ignatius talks about this in terms of spiritual indifference and preference, right? And that we have a certain set of preferences around change, like what change is good, what change is bad, what change is possible, what change is impossible. And so our practice starts to loosen up all of those constrictors. Gregory's got a follow up.
We need to put down deep roots in something that is enduring rather than lurching incessantly at everything that is trending. This is where I'm like, on paper, why the church is this amazing idea. So think about it. Like, hey, we live in a society with these operating myths. We're going to have our own way of framing this collectively with a shared life that's going to have spiritual and economic repercussions so that we can live out a counter narrative in the midst of things. And it'll be so beautiful that people will want to be a part of the beloved community. And we're going to engage in spiritual practices of discernment, jubilee economic practices, a politics of non-oppression. That didn't really work out for us. Like it's not a mistake that these things got co-opted. Yeah. Even like now with spiritual practices, you're talking about spiritual practices, Dan, and we talk about it all the time, and that's great. But then it's like, well, we both know that Amazon probably offers meditation classes because they twist it and use it as a wellness practice so people can cope with work and maybe pee in bottles, hold, be able to learn the discipline to hold it more so they don't have to pee in bottles as much. That's a depressing thought. Anyways, Catherine writes, "It feels like part of the current U.S. capitalist mythology soup is that certain changes won't happen, although we are metaphorically sawing off the branch we're standing on. For example, we'll still always have water to drink, even if we build an oil pipeline through the headwaters of the Mississippi watershed and let Nestle buy the Great Lakes."
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's another great angle on it, right, is that we're told it's the old thing of like, everything's going to be fine. Like, just don't worry. Everything's going to be okay. You'll still have water, even though we're putting water on the Chicago Board of Exchange. It'll be all right. Right. So that's a whole other part of any kind of hegemonic imperial brainwashing, is that it has to decouple you from your own human instinct about what's actually going on in the world, right? And it's this sort of, you know, societal gaslighting, like, oh yeah, don't worry about that, you know, oh gee, you know, the winter's disappearing, oh don't worry about that, that'll be fine, you know. It's like, you know, but again, we're in tune to these changes that are going on, and we can actually begin to trust our own embodiment as to what is good and what is not so good, right? But we're also suppressed as far as paying attention to what kind of change is really going on that we need to be addressing.
Mm-hmm. Sari's right. So this is why I'm planning to read the I Ching to deepen my relationship to change.
Yes. So that's good.
It's interesting. Like, one of the ideas that's often thrown out, like Simone Weil talks about this, about freedom, how we're off, and other people talk about this too, we're offered all the sorts of freedoms that are very superficial and not meaningful. And what we need is, in some ways, to be more constrained by what is real and meaningful. And what I mean is this, like, so the costs to this are hidden, this capitalist stuff. And if we actually lived within a way of living that was actually right-sized, it would feel constraining to us. So a good example, I saw this commercial, and this is an innovation, and it's new, and it's a change. This plethora of apps that you can get. So when you go to the pharmacy, you can search for the best price, which pharmacy has the best price. And this is supposed to help you as a consumer spend less. And this is great. The reason this is happening is because we don't have universal health care. So this thing is being celebrated, like this hyper consumer approach seems like freedom to us. And we're afraid, this is part of the narrative, of having universal health care because it'll diminish our freedoms, because it'll no longer be an industry. The amount of assumptions you have to make to see that as more or less freedom is astonishing. And that's what our society does. Like, we don't notice the damaging changes, and we see the changes that are offered us as meaningful when they're not meaningful changes.
There you go.
And
all right, well, that is a perfect lead-in to what will be Change and Fascism Friday.
Fascism Friday, everyone's favorite day of the week.
Yeah. All right. Well, great to see and hear from everyone. Mm-hmm. And
we'll see you Friday.
We'll see you Friday. All right. Bye.